The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our best ever Wi-Fi all around your home, your world is limitless.
Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast. It was Oliver Callan here filling in for Ryan Tuberty this week. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one happy place. And so this week, Irish filmmaker and author Hazel Hayes talked to us about writing her debut novel, Out of Love, and what it was like to interview Hollywood A-listers like Margot Robbie and Jack Black for her YouTube channel. Extreme artist Philip Gray paints in unexpected ways and in unusual places, like the volcanoes of Iceland and shark-infested waters. He told me all about his work and how he's helping his community to get back on track in these difficult times. Film critic John Maguire joined me in studio to look back at the life and career of the enigmatic comedy genius Peter Sellers, who died 40 years ago. Irish actress Amy de Vroon spoke to me about the huge impact COVID-19 has had on people in the creative industry and how this prompted her to start a podcast to help people in the same position as herself. And finally, I spoke to award-winning author Kevin Barry about hugging, lockdown, and his film Dark Lies the Island, starring Pat Short and Tommy Tiernan, which is getting released on the IFI Player. So that's it. Thanks a million for listening, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. Now I want to say hello to extreme artist Philip Gray, who's on the phone from his base in Kinsale, beautiful Kinsale in County Cork. Good morning, Philip.
Good morning.
Now, an extreme artist, that means you paint in unexpected and often dangerous locations. I want to read the list here. Everest Base Camp, 60 feet beneath the surface of shark-infested waters, the rainforests of Borneo, deep underwater in caves and atop the volcanoes of Iceland. And you're bringing your exuberance and breathing life into the community to help it get back on track in the midst of these difficult times. Tell us about extreme artist painting.
I used to be a Navy diver, and that's where obviously kind of the diving came in. Always a lover of adventure, and wanting to paint. So by combining adventure, combining travel, combining diving and extreme, and combining my painting, I suppose carved a wonderful, exciting career.
So you could have sat behind an easel and just painted there, but no, you had to get out and about doing it.
Yes, indeed.
I mean, it's a kind of a, particularly Everest Base Camp. Is it possible to paint up there?
We painted above kind of base camp.
Right.
We kind of painted on the ice packs, and we also painted on the summit of Island Peak. And I think that's probably kind of the highest painting that's ever been done. Done with pastels, and it was a tough climb. And yes, it was tough to paint because the temperature there is very, very cold. And obviously you are suffering from altitude sickness. And it wasn't easy. But, you know, as the saying goes, if it was easy, wouldn't everyone do it?
Yeah. And it doesn't affect the work itself because altitude, I presume, that's the addition that you paint. I'm looking at pictures of here. Can you describe what your paintings are actually like?
Well, obviously, on location, the paintings would not be as detailed as what I would do them in the studio.
Yeah.
And equally, when I paint under the water, I can't really use a brush. It doesn't really work very well. So I use a kitchen sponge, very technical. I use a palette knife. I use my fingers, and I use what's called a kind of a rubber shaper. It's almost like an eraser. And I use those tools to paint under the water. So in a sense, each environment dictates a different process of how to create the painting.
Yeah. What's the most kind of dangerous mission that you've gone on?
Probably the most dangerous one has been of recent times, and that was into China, to paint in an underwater city called Lion City.
Right.
And apart from the fact that we weren't supposed to be there, it was a restricted area, so we travelled we got into the water in an unrestricted area and travelled with PPVs, the propulsion vehicles, into the city. And the downside was that the city was at 40 metres. So I did almost 2 years training to train myself in technical diving and using a rebreather, which allowed me much longer period of time to spend in the city under the water to create the painting. So that was probably the most, you know, a lot of things could have gone wrong with that particular
It's like espionage meets extreme painting meets.
Yeah.
No, obviously you can't travel around the world at the moment, but you have done something for the people of Kinsale.
Yes, I mean, I've been struck by the huge level of community spirit that is very evident within Kinsale. And I felt really kind of proud to be associated and, you know, living in such a town. And I thought maybe if I did this painting and called it Community Spirit, we could raise funds for a combat campaign that the Kinsale Chamber of Commerce and Tourism had initiated. And in fact, they had initiated this during the lockdown. So I think we were probably kind of one of the first towns to actually start visualising how we're going to get our town back on track. So with that in mind, I created this painting, and we did a limited edition of 95 editions. And the nice thing was that when we set a deadline date and we took a name out of the hat, and thankfully, kind of, it was nice, someone local actually won the painting, which had a value of €8,000.
Right.
So someone was very happy.
That's done and dusted now.
So that's done and dusted. We are actually planning to do a few more incentives in order to help local charities. We are going to be kind of working with the wonderful and amazing old head of Kinsale Golf Links. In fact, I'm out there today to discuss a new incentive in order to be able to help KISS, which is the Kinsale Youth Support. And we're going to start kind of helping them, because I think that down the road, as a result of the COVID, I just kind of think that so many people are going to actually kind of need help. From a mental point of view.
It's great, and 10 grand you've raised for the Kinsale Comeback Campaign.
Yeah.
And listen, if people want to check out your work, it's there, philipgray.com, spelled like the colour, and you've got editions and all, you've got everything really for sale there.
It's actually G-R-A-Y, not
G-R-A-Y. G-R-A-Y, yeah. Sorry. Okay. Listen, Philip, great to talk to you, and continued success, and best wishes to everyone down there in Kinsale. And welcome back. Now, Peter Sellers died 40 years ago this summer. He's remembered as one of the great comedic geniuses, star of the Goons and the Pink Panther movies. He was a stalwart of the chat show circuit as well in the 70s, and he exuded that kind of jet-set movie star glamour that was typical of the age. He was only 54 when he died, though, and although he's seen as hugely influential on everyone, from the Beatles to Monty Python and even Steve Coogan, his films are often forgettable. His private life, though, was less than forgettable, and the Sunday Business Post, or the Business Post, we should call you now, film critic John Maguire is in studio to talk about this enigmatic, mysterious man, John.
That's it, Oliver. I'd love to be able to come into your studio, Oliver, and tell you all about Peter Sellers, the happy-go-lucky comedy genius, beloved by all who knew him and worked with him, who made a series of unforgettable movies, classics of the age, and died in his sleep in his bed at 110 years of age. But that's not what happened at all. That's nowhere near what it was like. Sellers was born in 1925 in Southsea in England, and he was the son of a couple of music hall performers, Bill and Peg.
Right.
And he was raised literally in the wings. They first took him on stage when he was 2 weeks old, and spent his entire young life, his childhood really, on stage with them. Now, Bill seems to have been a rather benign presence in Sellers' life, but Peg never left him and never left him alone. And even Spike Milligan, years later, a man beset by his own demons,
yes,
would remark that Sellers had far too close a relationship with his mother. She clung to him, and right. he was christened Richard Henry, but they called him Peter after an older brother who had died at birth. Wow. And Sellers was an only child. And I'm not, with my blunt scalpel, I'm not going to try to psychoanalyze the guy from 70 odd years later, but all the signs were there that this was a difficult and a rich psychological profile of yeah. his early years.
He would have been riddled with insecurities at a minimum.
Oh, from
anyway.
The start, right from the start. He was supposed to have been evacuated when the Second World War broke out to Cambridge, and Peg insisted that he stay in London all throughout the Blitz with her. And at the age of 17, then, he joined the RAF. Or he might have been conscripted, or he might have signed up. Nobody's quite sure. He joined the RAF and he went off to war. And the war really was the making of him. It was in the war and post-war that all of this kind of comedy scene developed in the UK. The guys that came back from the war had seen things that, you know, yeah. that had changed their view of the British establishment, the British society. And people like Spike Milligan, who we mentioned, Michael Bentine, Harry Secombe, they were all, they had all served in the war, and they came back and joined together as the Goons. And the Goons really are, there was nothing else like them up to that point. And even now, so many years later, their shows are still so funny. And that kind of Dadaist humour, that kind of absurdist, eccentric humour, nothing like that had been heard up to that point. And they were an enormous success. Replayed on all the English language speaking stations around the world. Played in the UK on the BBC Home Service. And they regularly had 3 and 4 million listeners at a time when that would have been just about everybody who had a radio.
Yeah.
And that was in 1951. And now, if you're going to play a clip,
and records,
it's still
as
funny.
Well,
I mean, it's still funny. Yeah. It's still funny 70 odd years later. And it's the way that they inspired Monty Python, obviously, but the Beatles in particular. There's a huge influence of the Goon Show on people like the Beatles. And Sellers was very friendly with the Beatles.
How did they influence the Beatles?
Well, the Beatles are very funny, and they have that same view of British society, and where they cherish the and criticise the eccentricities at the same time. Mm. That's what the Goons were trying to do. They were trying to say, this is who we are, and this is also hilarious. And yeah. if you take a step back from it, like the Beatles tried to do with almost every observational song they ever wrote, was try to take a step back and just tell you the story and find the humour in it yourself. That's what the Goons were trying to do, with all the silly voices and the clang clang and the patang patang and all that kind of stuff as well. But they really were in that group of post-war comedians that came out. Kenneth Horne in particular, with Round the Horn, which to me is actually just as funny as the Goons, but yeah. not as popular. And what came out of that, like Monty Python, That Was the Week That Was, all this kind of an attempt really to satirise the establishment.
It's funny that comedy kind of comes out of trauma, doesn't it? And that was kind of a national trauma.
Well, if we're going to get into trauma, Sellers is Mr. Trauma. Right. That there's things, there's
we'll
things in
that.
His life.
Yeah.
Let's hear some of the Goons.
The Goon Show. This is What Time Is It Eccles, which is a famous sketch. There's loads of it on YouTube. If you really want to go down that Goon Show YouTube hole, it's a fun place to be.
What time is it, Eccles?
Just a minute, I got it written down here on a piece of paper. And a nice man wrote the time down for me this morning.
Then why do you carry it around with you, Eccles?
Well, if anybody asks me the time, I can show it to them.
Wait a minute, Eccles, my good man.
What is it, fellow?
It's written on this bit of paper. What is 8 o'clock, it's written.
I know that, my good fellow. That's right. When I asked a fella to write it down, it was 8 o'clock.
Well, then, supposing when somebody asks you the time, it isn't 8 o'clock.
Well, then I don't show it to them.
It still works. The Spike and Peter Sellers there.
Yeah, Milligan and himself were great friends. And Milligan, like Sellers, had served in the war and had later Sellers, one of his wives, Britt Eklund, would have said that he was bipolar. I'm not a psychoanalyst or a psychologist, so I can't say for sure. He was never diagnosed with anything during his lifetime.
Yeah.
But Milligan was, and the two of them were very close friends and very closely attuned in the kind of comic sensibility that they had.
Yeah.
And when it comes together like that, with Harry Secombe and Michael Bentine as well, when it comes together like that, it is magical. And they are, and we'll see throughout Sellers' career that he was capable of great magic, but also that it would have come at a great cost to him.
Yeah. So from the Goon Show, he goes into the film industry.
Into movies. In British
film. This is probably where it starts to get really successful, but also probably crazy for Peter Sellers.
Yeah, the British film industry was in the ascendancy in the 1950s. They started making a lot of films that became very popular, and there was fewer American films, for instance. So there was a gap there for them to fill. And the Goons made their own film, Let's Go Crazy, in 1951. But really, Sellers' career started with The Lady Killers in 1955 when he starred opposite Alec Guinness. Alec Guinness would become a bit of a hero to him. Sellers would pick up on Guinness's ability to play a kind of a gimmick, really, his ability to play six or seven different characters in the same film. Sellers would do that again and again throughout his career.
Yeah.
And The Lady Killers was a big smash for Ealing Comedy, Ealing Studios. And The Mouse That Roared then in 1959, he played almost every inhabitant of this little fictional country that declares war in the US. A very, very funny film. And that multi-role trick, it was a stunt, but it was also something that would attract people into the cinema because it would be, you know, on the poster it would say, see Peter Sellers, it play every role in a movie.
Yeah.
And he was really, really good at it.
It's even impressive looking back now, isn't it?
It is very impressive. And it really, the multiple roles that he played were masks. Sellers liked to claim, basically describing himself as a character actor, I have no personality of my own whatsoever. I have no character to offer the public. If you asked me to play myself, I wouldn't know what to do. And that's really illuminative of the kind of psychology that was going on with him, the kind of personality that he had. He made two films with Stanley Kubrick, the first of which, Lolita, was, even now, is kind of a shocking film. He played this perverse, weird character, Claire Quilty. And even when you watch it back now, you kind of wonder, how did they get away with this in 1960 in the UK? It's a really strange and disturbing film. But again, he plays a couple of different characters in that, but it was in Doctor Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb.
Yeah, great title.
A great title. And he played three roles in that. And it brought a lot of his own, you know, there was a lot of elements that were on the page in the script that Sellers would work off, but then there was bits that he would just make up by himself. That's why the directors loved to work with him, because he would come up with things by himself. So a raised arm salute that the one that Dr. Strangelove keeps coming out with, that was a Sellers invention. The fact that he's in a wheelchair was a Sellers invention. The roundy glasses. He brought a lot of the character work to the character because, as he says himself, he was a tabula rasa. He was filling the blank in himself, not so much the blank on the page of the script. That absorption into character. It wasn't the method, it wasn't Stanislavski or anything like that. It was literally just bringing elements of character, and all the directors that he worked with loved him. But Kubrick said a very interesting thing when he was asked about Sellers in an interview. He said, Peter Sellers, there's no such person, which I thought was really interesting. When I was digging around to come in and talk to yourself, I thought, wow, that's a really interesting thing to say about an actor in your movie. There's no such person. And we can see throughout his private life and his personal life and his relationships with women in particular and his children that Kubrick was right. There was really nobody there. Once you go looking. And there's a particularly good biography. Sellers is a massive challenge to a biographer because of what I've just said. There's literally no character there. But there's a particularly good one called Mr. Strangelove, written by a guy called Ed Seacoff, who's a phenomenal writer. And in it, he basically tries to tease out who this guy was. And that's the challenge. There's literally a big blank gap right where there should be a Peter Sellers shaped object.
When he was making movies, like on set?
No, I don't think he was. He was a diva and a prima donna, and he made extraordinary demands on productions. He asked for everything, private jets, penthouse suites, huge amounts of money, obviously, because he was very popular after The Pink Panther, which he made in 1964 with Blake Edwards.
Dr. Strangelove is still a revered film, isn't it?
Absolutely adored,
Pink Panther movies, he's probably best remembered maybe by
this
most
is the
people,
thing. When you say say Peter Sellers, people would say, oh, the Pink Panther. But yeah, in the first Pink Panther in 1964, I think he was billed fifth. It's a David Niven movie. It's a Claudia Cardinale movie. It's not a
Inspector Clouseau
movie.
Is not the main...
But he came up with all of that Clouseau stuff. The hat, the funny accent, the slapstick, the physical comedy, all of that. That was all Sellers. None of that.
He was an amazing physical actor.
He was. He was able to throw himself around the place for comic effect. And he also knew when not to do that, which is a bigger talent, if you ask me. He was inspired by Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin and Harold Lloyd and all those great silent comics. But he knew when not to do that. He knew when to be still. He knew when to be quiet. He knew how to use his eyes and his expressions. All of that, technically, he's quite flawless almost. But it's his ability to generate character. And out of the Pink Panther, he made four more Pink Panthers, three in his lifetime and one that was cobbled together from outtakes by Blake Edwards.
Are they any good now when you look back?
No, I don't think.
Any of them?
I don't think the Pink Panther movies are particularly funny. I don't find them funny. I don't find Clouseau so funny. Individual scenes.
No.
Like you were talking about YouTube there a little while ago. If you were to watch minutes and minutes of Pink Panther movies on YouTube, you think this is hilarious, but they didn't survive in the way that some of his other work has.
Yeah, he was also in this period very good on chat shows.
Yes, he was the ultimate connoisseur and anecdote deliverer.
And he was funnier again by not being himself, wasn't it? It was like
it's hard
when he did the voices.
It's hard to know. He would come out and do a bit, which is fine. Now he would come out and sell a movie, or he'd come out and sell a record, because he made records as well. He was selling these records all the time, and he would come out and do a bit. But it was the presence, I think, and the potential for him to reveal and to tell stories and to give a taste of the so-called playboy jet set lifestyle that he was enjoying.
He was a raconteur.
Raconteur, that's the word I was looking for.
He was loved on The Late Late Show. Here he is with Gabo.
Oh, right, great.
Look, I'll do it for you if it's possible. I can do it. Look, if you don't like this vino, you don't pay for it. I can't say more. He said, all right, then I'll have it. I'll have it. So he tried this one. He had two glasses and knocked him sideways. And he was very, very sloshed, you know. He said, oi, Franco. Penny Quay. Yeah. What you got here? What was in that stuff? What was in that wine? He said, look, I'll tell you something that nobody knows. Shut the windows and the doors, because I'll tell you something. Not nobody knows this thing, what I'm going to tell you now. The Pope drinks two bottles, the same wine, every day from his life. He says, the Pope what? He says, the Pope drinks two bottles, the same vino, every day from his life. He says, no wonder he's got them four fellas carrying him around. Eh?
It's not even the punchline. It's actually the way he appears to be doing Michael Caine.
It's the delivery, but it's also
that's
the
from
fact...
That's Late Late, by the way, in 1970.
But that's a story. How many chat shows were there in the world? He was on every one of them.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's his ability to tour was unflagging. He went all around the world multiple times. But by the mid-1970s, shortly after that clip, after one too many flops, he made 60-odd films, and some of them were very odd indeed. Sellers was doing ads and guest slots on TV shows and lots of chat show appearances and things like that. And he was rescued, really, by the great American director Hal Ashby, who cast him as Chauncey in Being There, which was released in 1979 after Laurence Olivier had turned Ashby down.
It's funny you said
Sellers.
Our texters are already in on that one. 51551. Don't forget Being There, says this texter. Being There, a fantastic movie with him in a very serious role. Is he in a serious role?
I think it's a kind of a satire that we don't quite get anymore. It is a serious role, but it's also a comic role. And it's a very political film and a very socially aware film, particularly for the time.
It's subtle, isn't it?
It's, you know, there's a subtlety there, but there's also a nuance in our understanding of it. He plays this kind of blank, effectless character, a middle-aged man raised in isolation with only a TV as his source of information on how to behave. And the character's utter simplicity and transparency lead famous people and celebrities and politicians and statesmen to imagine that they had discovered this great intellect and this great thinker and somebody who would be able to show us the way forward. And it's a virtuoso performance, really, made all the more difficult because Sellers had to sustain a single note throughout the film.
It's almost just, excruciating in ways, isn't it?
He never so much as blinks. He never changes. And that's a really difficult thing to do for 10 minutes, let alone almost 2 hours of cinema. It's a really hard thing to do. But I think it's the closest that he ever got to playing himself on screen. It's the most autobiographical of his films. Now we can look back at it 30 or 40 odd years later. We can look back at it and say, well, this is being there is the film that presages Trump. This is Trump all over, etc., etc.
It looks like it, doesn't it, in ways.
That's not really the point that the film is making.
They're kind of, you know, if you dress a certain way, you know, you can speak in sound bites, but also appear to be profound.
You can go a long way by just saying yes. Just saying yes.
And there's a scene where the media kind of question, because he's on the way up accidentally in his performance of the media, and he's now being considered a contender for president. And he's literally asked, you know, what do you think of the Washington Post editorial? And he says, I don't read the newspapers, I only watch television.
There you go. I mean, it is. There's a lot there in terms of prophecy, you might say.
We have a clip from being there.
Oh, do we? Oh,
great. Let's play a little bit. This is the one note you're talking about.
In a garden, growth has its season. First comes spring and summer, but then we have fall and winter. And then we get spring and summer again.
Spring and summer?
Yes.
Then fall and winter?
Yes.
I think what our insightful young friend is saying is that we welcome the inevitable seasons of nature, but we're upset by the seasons of our economy.
Yes, there will be growth in the spring.
Well, Mr. Garner, I must admit that is one of the most refreshing and optimistic statements I've heard in a very, very long time.
It's the kind of the awkward silences and he's
the ticking clock. You can hear the ticking clock.
He's been absolutely literal because he's a gardener. But the president and this tycoon are watching on as though he's said something magical.
And something incredibly profound. And it's not really what Chauncey says at any point in the movie. It's what people say Chauncey has just said. That's the point of the film, really, is the interpretation of these little gnomic remarks that he makes.
I want to go through
I think it's a terrific film and well worth seeing.
It is. Totally agree with you. It's actually very funny in a lot of places as well. And Shirley MacLaine is in it as well. Tell us about then the overview of his private life and how it ends.
Well, he described himself as a hopeless romantic who was constantly falling in love. He married for the first time in 1951 to the Australian actress Anne Howe, and they had two children together. But in 1960, that relationship, that marriage broke up when Sellers fell in love with Sophia Loren when they were in Italy making a film called The Millionaireess for Billy Wilder. And there's a story in the Seacoff biography of him going back to London and waking one of his kids up in the middle of the night and saying, should I divorce your mother? I'm in love with Sophia Loren. You know what I mean? So in 1964, then, shortly after his triumph as Clouseau, when he was becoming a very, very popular actor and very, very wealthy, he married Swedish actress Britt Ekland after knowing each other for 2 weeks. He brought her over from a film set that she was on to San Francisco, where he was living at the time. He filled an apartment with mink coats and, you know, an entire wardrobe and tried to woo her through buying all these things. That marriage didn't really particularly last until 1969. They had a daughter together. In 1970, he married Miranda Quarry, the daughter of a British lord, and they divorced again shortly afterwards. And he had another marriage in 1977 to Lynn Frederick, who would be the woman who would ultimately inherit his entire estate after he passed away in 1980. His children were left £800 each.
Really?
Yeah. And the will was contested and his estate was contested, but they got nowhere with it. Frederick inherited everything and his children got nothing. And he'd had his health problems. He had apparently 13 heart attacks over the course of a week while he was filming with Billy Wilder. Wilder's remark was, in order to have a heart attack, you have to have a heart. But in 1980, he was in Dublin, actually making an ad for Barclays Bank, mm-hmm. and he collapsed. And very shortly afterwards, then he died.
Patrick
and
Drumcondra is texting to say, was DIT Grange Gorman Grounds now in April 1980.
That's when he had that. That's when he was filming for Barclays Bank. Yeah, he was only 54. I mean, it's kind of a crazy thing to think about, that he was literally only 54 years of age.
And he looks quite aged in being there, which was just the year before.
He does. He looks. But I think he's made up to look a little older than he was. But also years of alcoholism and drug abuse and cocaine had taken their toll on him, and not only physically but mentally. He'd had a series of what anybody would describe as nervous breakdowns now. All throughout the late 60s and 1970s, he was incredibly difficult. He was very difficult to be around, both in his personal life and his professional life.
He was hard work.
He was hard work.
If you want to know more about Peter Sellers, what would you recommend to watch?
Oh, the Seacock biography,
would... Mr.
Strangelove is a superb. But the films that we've mentioned, I think, would get you there. Being there, in reverse, if you like, Being There is particularly good. Strangelove and Lolita are superb. The Mouse That Roared is a great film. And The Ladykillers is something that everybody should watch. Is a superb film, and he's really good in it. And I think he might have been a better actor than people gave him credit for. I think Sellers became one of the early brands of comic actors. He wasn't given the range necessarily that he could have been capable of. And we see it occasionally in flashes, but it's not a sustained career. And there's a lot of duds in there, unfortunately.
Well, listen, John, thanks a million for that. It's the life and times of Peter Sellers. By the way, cinemas, everything?
No, not really. I think I think they will. I hope so.
Yeah.
I certainly do. I think we're all waiting for Christopher Nolan's Tenet. That's the big film that opens on August 26th. And hopefully with all the restrictions in place, people will flock out to see that and start buying
Fingers
movie tickets
crossed.
Again. Yeah.
John McGuire of The Business Post, thanks a million. Welcome back, and I'm joined on the line now by Hazel Hayes, who's an Irish filmmaker and author living in London now, who's just released her debut novel, Out of Love. Good morning to you, Hazel.
Good morning, Oliver. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And I have your book in my hand here, and it's a rather beautiful thing, and it's very much got that kind of Generation Z or X, whatever they're calling these days, vibe about it.
Oh God, I'm neither of those now. I'm a millennial, I think. I wouldn't fit into any of those categories.
Yeah, and you have 250,000 subscribers on YouTube. So I want to start there. And because you've done a lot of writing, directing, social media influencing, but when you have 250,000 people on YouTube waiting for you to upload videos, is that kind of what's that stress and pressure like?
Well, they've probably stopped waiting now, I'll be honest, because they've been getting more few and far between now for a while. But I actually started it because I studied at DCU and went straight into a job at Google.
Yeah.
And after I was working in YouTube and working with YouTubers who at the time it was sort of like, who are these, you know, young people making stuff from their bedroom? It was sort of unheard of, which is crazy now when you think about everything we have on TikTok and everything else. But I started working with them and decided to try it myself, I guess. I'd always been creative as well. I'd been writing, I'd been acting. So I decided to start my own channel kind of as a hobby, I guess, just on the evenings and weekends, and to make me better at my job at YouTube, to understand how it felt to actually make content and put yourself out there and all that kind of stuff. And it just sort of took off. So eventually, after a few years, I flew the nest and left the cushy job at Google and the very lovely on-site facilities to do this. So it's a bit nerve-wracking, it's a bit scary, but every step of the way, I have to say, it's been really lovely. Like those people who follow me have all been just so supportive and encouraging and positive, and I've never really felt that there was too much pressure. Like definitely when it was, you know, my bread and butter and I had to get a video out every week. But sure, everybody gets that with their job. You know, you have to do your job.
That's
so
true.
Yeah, it wasn't too bad.
So obviously you're working for YouTube and then your hobby is YouTube. You obviously had some insights then to grow the audience, did you?
I did, but I didn't listen to any of them, which is why it stopped at 250,000, which sounds like a huge amount. But I mean, I was working with people who had millions of subscribers and growing and growing. Yeah. And like, I knew that, you know, there were ways of doing it. I could have picked something very niche and specific, like beauty or gardening or yoga or whatever. And that's the way to really grow an audience, is to just sort of stick to one thing. But I didn't want to. I sort of, as I said, I wanted it to be a creative outlet, and I had all these different things I was interested in. I was making short films and comedy sketches and everything from horror to comedy and poetry and, you know, sort of vlogs as well, where I was just chatting. So I wanted to be able to have that freedom, so I didn't really pigeonhole myself. And in doing so, I guess I limited myself a bit, but I didn't really care, because it was never about that. It was never really about making a huge audience. It was about getting better at what I do.
Yeah, so you, artists and the art kind of pulled you out, really, didn't it? So you had your YouTube career there for a bit, and then you obviously decided to jump out of the safe ship.
Yeah, yeah.
And
which
it's a tough time
scary.
For artists now. So obviously, you know, this is a big risk in your career, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's really funny. You know, like a couple of years ago, this did seem like the crazy thing. And I definitely remember, you know, sitting around the family dinner table and trying to explain to people why I was leaving the pension and the gym and everything else to pursue this thing, which seemed so unstable and so new and strange. It's very difficult to describe, you know, to your family what it is you're doing. Oh, I make videos. And it's like, what are they about me, I suppose? Like, it just sounds so self-indulgent and, yeah, a bit narcissistic or whatever. But I was so sure of it. And I have to say, the mammy was very supportive. So, yeah, I took a massive financial cut in those first couple of years while I got everything ramped up. But yeah, you know, it's just that freedom. It's just to be able to kind of, the art kind of pulled me into it. And now I'm more happy than ever that I did it. I mean, there's so many people really struggling at the moment, of course. And I have to say, I'm incredibly privileged. I'm incredibly lucky. I'm in the two, you know, industries that were barely hit, which is publishing and online content. So thank God, like, I'm actually okay. And I'm looking at people now struggling with redundancies and that kind of thing, and I'm thinking, well, I might have ended up out of my job anyway, so
yeah.
I suppose it was the right decision at the end of the day.
Along with that kind of horror short film, which I'll come to in a minute, you had a thing called Tipsy Talks, where you're interviewing big name stars. I mean, you had Amy Schumer, you had Saoirse Ronan, and I watched the one with Margot Robbie. You got on very well with her.
We had a great time, me and Margot. Yeah, I couldn't believe it. She was lovely, absolutely lovely. Yeah, she wanted mimosas. We'd normally have a bit of bubbly, but she, yeah, they all drank mimosas on the set of Suicide Squad, so that's what she wanted that day. And then I saw her again a couple of years later when she did I, Tonya, which was lovely. But yeah, that was a series that came out of nowhere. I started doing it with friends where we just have a few drinks, because I sort of find, you know, people will open up, and not because they're drunk, but you put a glass in somebody's hand and suddenly psychologically it's like you're in the pub and you're just having a chat. So I was sort of doing them with YouTubers and friends and that kind of thing. And then randomly Universal asked me to do one with Amy Schumer, and it sort of went mad from there. I've had Amy Adams and Daisy Ridley and all sorts of people. It's been great. For no reason that I can really understand.
No, it's really good fun.
It's good crack.
I mean, it helps Margot Robbie's brand as well, because you see these actors really grumpy on these, they call them movie junkets, where they do interview and after interview. But she's there happily having a mimosa with yourself.
I know, and it's awful. I always get told this right before I meet people. Oh, I've heard she's a bit of a so-and-so. And they never are. Do you know, of all the people I've met, they've all been completely pleasant, completely lovely. The chances are someone probably caught them when they were jet-lagged or they were having a bad day. And, like, we've all had a bad day, you know. So, no, I think a lot of those rumours aren't true anyway to begin with. So,
now, you've done a couple of short films about horror films, really.
Yeah.
What attracts you to horror?
What attracts me to horror? I like... God, that was about to sound very dark. I like sort of the impact that you can have on an audience with horror. Like, yeah. I've physically been in a cinema. We had a screening of a horror series I made called Prank Me at a Buffer Film Festival in Toronto, and I got to actually sit and see a whole audience of people watch. And oh, it was just something about seeing them all sort of like withdraw into themselves at the tense bits and then jump at the jump scares and, yeah, you know, that very visceral physical reaction that it has on people. I think it's just, maybe there's a God complex at play, I don't know, but but it can be really funny. In the same way, I always say there's a very fine line between that and comedy, because like, you're setting something up for whether it's a punchline or it's a jump scare or something. You're sort of building attention and building towards something, and then you get that kind of payoff. And also it's weirdly like therapeutic for me as well, because I suffer from awful night terrors. And I've half of the stuff that I've put in things has come out of my own dreams, which is awful. Right. But in the same way, kind of cathartic, because I get to sort of make something out of it. And I don't know, shape it or own it or have it gives me a bit more power over the stuff, because when stuff just comes to you in a dream, you can feel quite powerless. But
Do you mean night terrors as opposed to nightmares? There's a difference.
Yeah,
isn't there
is a difference. So yeah, I do have awful nightmares as well. But
night terrors are kind of recurring.
It's recurring, and it feels very potent and very real. And often you can kind of wake up with sleep paralysis, where like you physically can't move until you sort of you've calmed down and you're sort of stuck in it for a second. Yeah, it can just feel a lot more real. So I don't really get it as much anymore now, to be honest. I was sort of struggling with my mental health there for a few years quite badly, but I've done an awful lot of work on it, and I have to say the dreams have let up as a result. But yeah, that's sort of, I channel all of that into my work, I think, which is partly where the horror came from.
Have you been able to sort of examine why you were getting night terrors and sorted it out?
Yeah, I have actually. I have. I think I've done an awful lot of work in the past few years. I met a wonderful therapist who I actually was diagnosed with BPD and PTSD, which is post-traumatic stress disorder, which I think a lot of people think, oh, it's just, you know, war veterans and that kind of thing. It's, you know, someone who's been through something that violent or extreme gets it. But actually, it's really very common, and trauma is, you know, so common among the population. It can be anything from a car crash to assault or abuse, or even growing up in just a chaotic environment with a parent who was maybe an alcoholic or depressed themselves or whatever else, can lead to certain traumas sort of existing within the brain, and then you becoming a bit triggered in later life, usually in relationships and that kind of thing. So I've been reading a lot about it and studying it, because I find I come at things best when I can understand them. So I've been learning a lot about trauma and about mental health the past few years, and doing a lot of work myself with a therapist who I'm actually proud to say now I'm kind of finished up with her, and we sort of did our journey. Although you're never finished healing, you know, you're never done, you never stick a fork in you. I finished up with her last December, sort of feeling just so much better, and I'd say I'm the happiest I've ever been now. I'm very, very good within myself.
And I want to come to the book now, because you've said there is a connection between horror and romance.
I have.
Is it fair to call it a romantic novel?
I suppose it is. I had someone the other day sort of saying, like, God, I thought that was very strange. Hazel Hayes was doing a romance. And then I read it and I was like, oh, okay. I think, yeah, you know, I'm always of the opinion that, you know, you can call things whatever you want, really. Like, there's so many things out at the moment. And if I'm going to compare something similar to this, like Fleabag or Normal People, or even films like Eternal Sunshine or 500 Days, which were inspiration, which it's difficult to pin down. Like, are they dramas? Are they comedies? You know, Eternal Sunshine has almost horror elements to it. So I think things are just more abstract and obscure across the board now. It's not really that, you know, if it's a half hour, it has to be a sitcom, and things aren't really adhering to the same rules. So with the book, I'd say it really spans across a lot of genres. It's set against the backdrop of a relationship, absolutely, and it is about a couple, but really it's more about her experience of the relationship and what's going on kind of in her head
and it's
throughout
happening, it's happening in reverse, isn't it? So we start at a breakup.
That's the sci-fi coming in. See, there's loads of different things in my head.
But it's a great technique, because you kind of get the bad bits over with early in the book.
You get them out of the way. That's a really nice way of looking at it, Oliver. I hadn't thought of that. I don't know. It wasn't really intended to be that way. What happened was I had written a short story, because I sort of learned my craft on short stories. I studied at the Irish Writers' Centre, and that's how I learned to write, was stories, before I went on to scripts and started doing that. So I came back to it for this. I had this story in my head about a breakup, and I just had to get it onto the page. And any writer or artist or anyone who makes anything listening will understand, sometimes it's like if you just have to vomit, like it's going to happen. There's nothing you can really do, so you almost can't take credit for it. But yeah, because I just had to get it out of me and onto the page. And with that, I had this story about this breakup, where the guy has come to collect his stuff from the apartment that they once lived in together, and she sort of packed it all up for him, and it's their last few moments together. But as she's sort of making him a cup of tea and going through that process with him, she's reminiscing on everything that's happened since since the breakup, and it's been a couple months, and she's sort of been living there on her own and finding her feet, I guess, and going through the ups and downs that you do with grief. So that was what that well, I was about to say chapter, but that story was about. And then a lot of people kind of said to me, God, I kind of want more of these people. And I was like, yeah, they're living in my head now, and I want to do more with them. But yeah. I just didn't think telling the story forwards was what I wanted to do. I was like, well, it's done now. And actually, when I think about it, I think the big thing for me in any breakups, grief really, but breakups specifically, you always have that moment of like, God, why did I ever love them in the first place? And I wish I'd never met them to begin with. And were we ever happy? Like, was it all a front? And you sort of feel like you've failed because the relationship hasn't lasted forever, when that's not necessarily the point of a relationship. You know, maybe it was meant to serve you for a time. So because I kept coming back, I kept getting stuck in the stuck point of why had we even been together? I was like, this is what I want to explore. So I decided to write it backwards and go right from there, and actually take them all the way back to when they met, and really see the love that was there to begin with, and how it started to unravel. And it's never just one. Everyone's like, oh, what did they do? Did they cheat on you? Did they, you know, run over your puppy with their car? You know, it's like, was there one thing? And there often isn't. It's often years of stuff. And not just, yeah, it's not just your stuff. It's your parents. It's everything.
Is there horror in the sort of that it's a form of grief, but worse, the person you've lost continues to live on and without you?
Yeah, I firmly believe that there should be a place where exes can just go and exist. Now, not that anything bad happens to them there. Just you know, exist happily, but just not on your plane of existence anymore. So you never have to see them. And just wouldn't life be so much easier if you just knew they were alive and well over there? I think when I said, like, the joke was that I was like, you know, I couldn't think of anything more horrific than love. And that's where that's come from. But it's true, like, to really love somebody that deeply, to give yourself over, to be that vulnerable, there's kind of truly nothing more horrific than to lose that love in whatever way. Like, it's one of the worst things, as most people listening will know, it's one of the worst things that you will ever go through in life. Yeah. Is to lose that kind of love, and to have to go through the next chapter by yourself, and to find yourself again. It's really tough, and worse than any horror film, I reckon.
Yeah. No, it's a beautifully written book, and it's quite cinematic, obviously, because you have film experience in you, and it's like a meditation on love in ways.
Thank you.
And you actually financed it in a very interesting way.
I did, yes. Well, I had crowdfunded my first short film, which we shan't speak of because it's awful. But a good first try. I'd crowdfunded that a few years ago. And I mean, as I said, like, having that YouTube audience, I think a huge part of it was building a platform, knowing I would want to branch out and make my own stuff, make a name for myself one day. And it was wanting that support, I suppose, for when it came. And it did, the time came. I was ready to write my book, and I turned to my lovely, lovely audience and said, listen, I want to do this, but I'm not going with a traditional publisher. I want you involved in the process. So I crowdfunded it with a company called Unbound. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like Patreon, really, or one of those kind of crowdfunding sites where you can pre-order the book itself, or you can kind of pledge for other things, like I'm having a couple of hangouts coming up with some people to talk about film and writing and that kind of thing. So there was different things. But yeah, so they basically funded it. So if we hit a certain level, it was good to go. So that's what my job was in the beginning, just to get it to there. And then
they've done a great job on it.
Oh, God, you know, they've absolutely knocked it out of the park. I didn't expect it.
Out of Love, that's Hazel Hayes' debut novel. That's yourself. And where can we get it? Amazon, Waterstones, all the usual places.
All the usual. I got several screenshots from the mammy and relatives. Oh, the mammy says, by the way, to tell you that she's been loving the morning show, Oliver. I'm under orders. Yeah, they sent me screenshots to say it's up on Easton's, and I think it should be in bookshops. But if not, you know, try and support your local bookshops and ring them, get them to get it in, all that kind of stuff.
I see Aisling B is the blurb on the book. She says it's only great. Is she a friend?
I nearly died. Is she a friend? No, I'd love to say she was. We have messaged a bit. What happened was, the book actually got optioned for a TV series, which is brilliant news.
Wow. So congratulations.
Thank you so much. So James Norton's production company have optioned it.
Very good.
And they knew Aisling and sort of gave the manuscript over to her. And with that, I woke up one morning and I had a DM on Instagram from Aisling B saying, oh, I'm reading the book and I love it, and I'm not even supposed to show it. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to be telling you this. And I nearly nearly died. So I asked her, would she be happy to give a quote? And she did, which is amazing. Brilliant. It's amazing. I had Marion Keyes tweeting about it last week. Yeah, I'm beside
myself.
It's
just great,
honestly,
to get support from that
it's
community.
It's so lovely. And I have to say, it's such a lovely community as well. Like, you come into it as a newbie and you're afraid it might be competitive or whatever, but not at all. Everyone's been so welcoming and so lovely.
We
supportive.
Wish you all the best with it.
Thank you.
And all the best to your family as well up in Portmarnock. Hazel Hayes, good morning to you.
Thank you so much, Oliver.
Let's go to the phones in the meantime, because I want to talk to Amy de Vroon, who's an Irish actress, writer, voiceover artist that you might recognise from the huge, huge hit television series Line of Duty. But when COVID-19 hit and all of Amy's work was stopped practically overnight, she began to think of all the people in creative industries that were just as impacted as her. So she's going to tell us all about that. Good morning to you, Amy.
Good morning, Oliver. How are you?
Great to talk to you. And you've had wonderful success. And I think everyone will probably know you best for your portrayal of Steph in season 5 of Line of Duty. Tell us what that was like for you.
Oh, it was brilliant. It was I was playing basically Stephen Graham's wife in it. She was kind of the guest lead that comes into the show.
Yes.
I was booked for a couple of episodes. And then when I was working on the show, the creator, Jed Mercurio, kind of came up to me and he was like, yeah, I love what you're doing, so we want you back for the finale, which was incredible. So, yeah, it was a really good experience. I got to kind of play outside my comfort zone. I was playing a scouser and, you know, so it's always these nice little things that you get to do. So it was incredible. And the acting on the show is just so great, and the actors are incredible, and
it's
and
loved
as well.
It's all loved. And where are you from originally, Amy?
Dublin. So
you're from Dublin. The Scouse accent.
Yeah. It was basically a childhood misspent watching Brookside. That's basically where I got the Scouse accent from.
I think Jimmy Carr has a way into Liverpool accents. He's like a chicken, chips and a can of coke.
Yeah, it's all the exactly okay. Same, isn't it?
So, I mean, you're doing Line of Duty, big star and all of that. Everything's going very well. And then the thing happens. How were you feeling when coronavirus hit?
Yeah, it was a really weird one. I was filming on a project. It got paused and kind of, unlike everyone else, it was kind of like, you know, anyone else who got paused, it might pick up. It will pick up when, you know, all this is over.
Yeah.
And I suddenly realised, I was kind of looking around and I've seen people who, you know, other artists and actors who maybe hadn't got a gig for a long time and suddenly got a gig, but it was stopped, you know.
Yes.
And it was just kind of, in one way, there's a great comfort in it because we're all in it together.
Yes.
But in another way, I was kind of going, this is just so detrimental. We're trained as actors or artists to be able to, you know, go without work for a while. But the fact that the whole world is stopped, and as well, your work, you know, your identity can be so tied up in your work that it can really affect your mental health. So I was doing a lot of voice work from home because I had the mic there and because obviously studios weren't open. And it kind of just came to me to create a podcast and talk to other people and see how they were feeling about the situation as well. And what's really interesting is everyone has the same feelings, no matter what your chosen art form is. A lot of people just have the same feelings and insecurities, and we just haven't really ever spoken about it because we're supposed to be sort of, you know, delighted to get the work and be happy all the time.
Yes.
And, you know, it's a vulnerability that a lot of people don't want to kind of let, you know, open themselves up to.
Just be careful with the phone there, Amy. Just we lost you just for a little second for the odd word.
Oh, okay.
So just hold it as steady as you can, please.
I will indeed.
I want to ask you about motherhood because you have a little tiny tot in the middle of all this.
Yes, a 13-month-old called Billy. And yeah, she's an absolute dote. But obviously when COVID-19 hit, you know, she however many months ago that was, she was going through all these developmental changes and, you know, our family can't see her, you know, and it's and also you're in the doors the whole time with the tiny little baba. So it's very intense.
Yeah.
And, you know, and in one way, we were both myself and my husband were so grateful because I'd worked constantly through pregnancy and afterwards. So it's great to have the time with her. But it's this kind of double-edged sword where there's also the intensity of not being able to get away from it.
Yeah.
At the same time.
How did you cope with that?
Lots of yoga, okay. Lots of meditation, and just also just being grateful for it, and just kind of going, putting it in perspective. I mean, all that we have to do is stay indoors and enjoy our beautiful child. And there's so many people out there whose families were really affected, you know, mm-hmm. by COVID-19, or you know, or people who are struggling to have children. So you know, in perspective, it's not a bad complaint to have. It's just that little added intensity that, you know, at a time like that is crazy.
Yeah, you have a good attitude to it. And when you mentioned you were working while pregnant, you actually hid your pregnancy while working, did you?
Yeah, for a long time. I think I only even mentioned it, like I say, online. It's not that I have a great big following or anything, but I only mentioned it online kind of when I had a month to go. I was really lucky in that I was quite neat, and it was easy to hide. Yeah. But a lot of that as well was kind of, you know, there's a huge fear with actors, I think, when you have a baby, that you're never going to work again. And, right. you know, and I was kind of going, oh, God, when people see now that I'm pregnant, they won't employ me again. And so a lot of the jobs that I did, we just hid it and carried through. And now looking back, I'm going, no, I think, you know, could have taken it easier on myself. Yeah. But there's definitely a kind of a fear there, because I suppose in an industry as small as ours, particularly in Ireland, you're always kind of going, well, someone else can come and do the job and they won't have a bump or, you know, or a child.
That's so striking, though, that you even felt that you had to hide it.
Yeah. I think it's a mark of kind of where we are, I suppose, as mothers in the industry. You know, I don't. I think you're kind. There's an expectation to be able to do it all, and to sort of and almost like it, a fear that, you know, if you let people know that you've children, that you seem less capable, or that, you know, you're not going to be able to do that gig, or you're not going to be able to stay longer, or, you know, yeah. or commit in the same way that you could before.
I think a lot of women who want both career and family will relate a lot to that.
Yeah.
Is this a feature of the podcast? And tell us about the podcast. What's it called?
Yeah, it's called Year of the Selfie. And it's speaking to artists. I mean, there are a lot of actors on it, because I know a lot of actors. But also an Irish fashion designer, a motivational speaker who used to be an actor, directors, illustrators. So we've had a variety of people, and I guess it's just exploring the link between, you know, your mental health and your creativity and your identity being tied up in your art, and how that can kind of negatively, you know, affect you. And it's kind of just creating a very quiet, safe space to have the chat and kind of see that we're all kind of feeling the same and being vulnerable and you know, and that we all kind of have the same insecurities and the same fears. And so many people have just gotten in contact with me after hearing the podcast and just saying, like, I actually felt the same way, and I can't believe so-and-so feels like that, or that person.
Yes.
Because we present ourselves on social media, or, you know, in the great, you know, or when we're at work, as kind of, yeah, we can do it all and we're flying it and we're doing great. And the reality is, you know, we may never reach the heights that in our hopes and dreams we've expected to. And, you know, and my idea of success, you know, it might look to somebody else like I'm hugely successful, but in my head I'm going, well, now I also want to achieve this and this and this. And, you know, so we're all kind of feeling it together.
It's all relative.
It's all relative. And I think in this kind of time, it was a time where everyone couldn't run from themselves anymore. Yeah. We all had to take a great big hire to look at ourselves.
In your podcast discussion about mental health, particularly and the impact on artists, did you reach a kind of a conclusion of what is the best thing to do? Particularly, I'm thinking of those who are in live music and live theatre, mm-hmm. and their identity totally stripped away. And the great fear, of course, are hearing those words, no live music, in the hospitality industry. Did you reach any sort of conclusions on how those, what they can do to help themselves?
Yeah, I think a huge thing was being able to create a gap between yourself and your art form. So it doesn't mean that you have to be less passionate about what you do, but that your identity isn't solely tied up in it, so that when something goes good or bad, that you can kind of keep even, you know, that you're not constantly on this roller coaster of emotions sort of dependent on your work. And there's a great TED talk by Elizabeth Gilbert about creativity and how the artist became the genius, and that kind of created a huge detriment to people's mental health when this happened at this point in history. It's a great TED talk. And it's definitely something that I think ties even in with the idea of the podcast. And I think, yeah, if anyone listens to that, they'll get a good sense of it. Will give them comfort if there are any artists out there looking for a bit of comfort, for sure.
you call it Year of the Selfie. What's the play there? Is it Year of the Self or...?
I think Year of the Self. I think it's just the idea of, you know, how we portray ourselves maybe on social media and the selfies and how filtered everything is. And that actually this is a year where we have to actually turn it on ourselves and look at ourselves, but in a kind of a truthful way. So it's just kind of a play around with all those words. So, yeah.
Have you changed your own output and how you view your own social media?
Oh, yeah. I think definitely. I think, well, for a long time I've been doing that. I try to kind of keep it as much to work as possible and as minimal as possible as well. You know, because I think, and also, and step away from it when needed, because I think, you know, we all kind of, you see things like with the Caroline Flack and things like that, people like pile in on top of each other and,
yes. You
know, kind of with opinions. And I think sometimes it's just really good to just step away or just be mindful that it's not a real space, you know.
Yes.
It's photographs. It's you know, and we forget
it's mob rule, isn't it? People acting. It's people acting in a gang, isn't it? And they're not even sure of themselves what they're doing. They're just looking for the little click in the brain. Exactly. Some texts are coming in. 51551. Ask Amy de Vroon about Adrian Dunbar, Mother of God.
Mother of God.
that could mean a brilliant. Lot of things.
he's so lovely, so normal, and very just a very nice person. Like and makes you feel extremely welcome, and just a really down to earth, lovely person.
Yeah, he's been campaigning for Neil Morrissey to return. Are you joining that campaign?
I think they should bring him back. It's back on BBC One, isn't it? The first series, so that'll remind everyone of him again.
Should
bring him back. Why not?
Absolutely. So you finished. You've got series one of the podcast done. That was just gone, isn't it? So when is series two starting, and what can we expect?
Yes, it's coming next week. So there'll be more artists, more kind of open conversations, and it's lovely. It's just getting more and more kind of relaxed. The chat. I'm getting better even at just chatting to people, you know, because it's not my gig. I'm not someone who interviews people normally on a day to day basis. So I'm even getting more comfortable in the chats and. So there should be a nice new series coming. I just took a little break at the end of the first series. I wanted to top and tail it. The first one was actually with my husband. He's an illustrator, a storyboard artist, and a director by trade. So
it's a lot of art.
I started with him. And
a lot of art in the house.
A lot of art. Yeah.
Listen, that's great. Year of the Selfie is the podcast. We can check it out and check out season 5 of Line of Duty as well. Amy, it's been great to chat to you.
It's been lovely chatting.
Thanks a million. Good morning to you.